Peter.
Mr. President, following up on Vladimir Putin for a moment, he said recently that next year when he has to step down according to the Constitution as president, he may become prime minister, in effect, keeping power and dashing any hopes for a genuine democratic transition there. Senator McCain
said... I've been planning that myself.
Senator McCain said yesterday, sir, that when he looks into Putin's eyes, he sees a K, a G, and a B. And he would never have invited him to Kennebunkport. And he says it's time we got a little tough with Vladimir Putin. I'm wondering if you think, is Senator McCain right? And what would it mean for Russian democracy if, when you leave power, assuming you do in January 2009, Vladimir Putin is still in power?
Yeah. One of the interesting... My leadership style has been to try to be in a position where I actually can influence people. And one way to do that is to have personal relationships.
Wolf. Thank you, sir. A simple question. What's your definition
may
of the
require
word?
Require a simple answer.
What's your definition of the word torture?
Of what?
The word torture. What's your definition?
That's defined in U.S. law. And we don't torture.
Can you give me your version of it, sir?
John. Whatever the law says.
Good afternoon. I do not have anything to start with, so we can go to questions.
Does the administration, does the president believe that head slapping and simulated drowning are necessary tactics to use against suspected terrorists to keep America safe?
Let me take a step back. In the days after 9/11, when we were getting a steady stream of intelligence about potential new attacks, the president faced a lot of challenges, and he asked his national security team to make sure that we designed and made sure that within the laws we had all the tools that we needed in order to keep this country safe and to prevent another attack. Oftentimes, the best information that you get is from the terrorists themselves. They know where the other terrorists are hiding and what the other terrorists are planning. And to win the war on terror, we must be able to detain them, interrogate them, question them, and when appropriate, prosecute them. The policy of the United States is not to torture. The president has not authorized it. He will not authorize it. I am not going to comment on any specific alleged techniques. To do so would provide the enemy with more information for how to train against these techniques. We do not torture. And I think another thing that everyone should keep in mind is that here in this country, it's quite a testament that even though we have a sworn enemy of the United States that has declared war on us and has acted upon that and killed thousands of our own citizens here just 6 years ago, we are still having a debate to talk about how we should make sure that we treat people and that we don't torture them. And that is quite a testament to this country. The bottom line is that we do not use torture.
In September of last year, the president told the country about what had been a classified program of CIA prisons in other countries around the world. At that time, he said all the terrorists who were held, or alleged terrorists who were held in those sites, were no longer there. Today, do those prisons still exist, and are there alleged terrorists being held?
The president said that a small number of suspected terrorist leaders and operatives captured during the war had been held and questioned outside the United States in a separate program that was run by the CIA. The president also at the time said that we were not going to, while we had talked about the people that had been held, terrorists that were held, they were then transferred to Guantanamo Bay, that we were not going to tell you every time that happened.
Do these sites in countries outside the United States operated by the CIA, are they still actively operational?
I'm not going to comment on that. If the CIA decides to comment, I'll let them. What I can tell you is that any procedures that they use are tough, safe, necessary, and lawful. Safe, necessary, and lawful, these techniques, and they've helped save American lives and those of our allies, prevent attacks on Americans and our allies. Help prevent attacks in countries that we consider to be our allies, and we have prevented attacks here.
Have any attacks been averted since President Bush revealed the existence of this program because terrorism suspects have been held in the program?
I can tell you that General Hayden and Fran Townsend, the President's National Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor, have said that this program continues to save lives. When we can, we declassify information so that we can provide it to you. But right now, I don't have any to provide.
What is your definition of torture?
Well, that's clearly spelled out in the Detainee Treatment Act, and interpreted under the December 2004 opinion.
Are you satisfied that there's enough clarity in sort of the definition?
Very. I am very satisfied that this country is following the laws. We follow our laws and we meet our international obligations. I think that this country meets the laws of our nation and meets its international obligations. We believe that we are following our laws and that we are meeting our international obligations.
You feel that there is enough clarity in the definition that the administration has put forward that they wouldn't be able to look at something and say, well, that seems
subjective. I'm not saying that reasonable people couldn't disagree on complex questions. That's possible. If there were an attack on this country, all of the questions in here would be very different. You would be asking me, how did you allow this to happen? And what I am telling you is that within the law, we are making sure we are doing everything we can to prevent it from happening again.
But what's to stop another country from then taking their own definition and interpretation based on the administration?
As I understand, under the Geneva Convention, every country was supposed to interpret it for themselves. And now we have.
As I understand it, I believe that the Geneva Convention said that every country could interpret for themselves what that language meant. I'm recalling that from the debate that we had in this country from a year and a half ago.
It basically says that if there is some kind of a problem with clarity, it is supposed to be taken to an international crimes court. So where...
Which we are not going to do.
Why not?
I don't think it's necessary. The United States does not torture. With that, I'll take your questions. Yes.
I want to ask about the President's statement this morning on the interrogation methods. He said, he repeated, obviously, like he did yesterday, that the U.S. government doesn't torture people. But these memos make it sound like the definition of what's permissible is so expansive that you could say we don't torture, and almost anything can be true falling into that. What do you say to that?
What I say is that the United States policy and our laws is not to torture. Yes, we do interrogate al-Qaeda terrorists. These are people who intend to harm us. We do not torture them.
So where is the line between harsh but legal interrogation and torture?
The experts have debated that. They have come up with an opinion. It is there for everyone to see. There's a public document that interprets the statute that is from the Office of Legal Opinion from the Justice Department. It's on the website for anybody to read.
Yeah, I went back and read the 2004 memo.
Did you get through the whole thing?
I was looking for a definition of torture, because we know that in 2002 it defined it a certain way, and then the 2004 memo was intended to redefine it, or to, I believe, broaden the definition of torture. And I wasn't sure if I came up with the definition. I mean, I saw language that said specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering. Is that the definition from the 2004?
I don't have the document with me, and so let me decline on that. But what I will tell you is that you might not have gotten to the parts of the footnotes of that document in which it says that it's their legal conclusion that in the analysis and looking at the earlier memo that their legal justification that it would have been I would just have to refer you to the Department of Justice. It's a very complicated legal matter.
Why can't the White House articulate a definition of torture rather than just saying go read the memo, which is, you know, extremely dense?
It is extremely dense. It's very complicated. I'm not going to do it from here. I'm not a lawyer.
Why can't the White House come up with some definition other than just saying we don't torture?
Well, I think that the question is I could speculate, and I shouldn't. I do think that it's appropriate that applications of the laws and techniques are kept secret, and I don't think that providing those to the American public would serve them well.
But the American people can't for themselves decide if what is being done in their name is appropriate or not. It's something they agree with or not.
I disagree. I think the American people recognize that there are needs that the federal government has to keep certain information private in order to help their national security. We cannot provide more information about techniques. It's not appropriate.
I'm asking for a definition so that instead of any kind of wink-wink or you understand, or here's what we think torture is.
Part of that, in my opinion, part of that is then detailing out techniques, which we would not do. I'm not going to get into specifics. I'm not going to get into specific tactics.
This is the whole issue right here. What is the president's policy? What are his thoughts? I mean, I think a lot of
I told you what the policy is. The policy is that the United States does not torture.
Dana, why did the President feel the need today to weigh in on the subject of the CIA interrogation program in what was ostensibly to be a statement on the economy? Did he feel that the disclosures about the harsh treatment of detainees was somehow casting the administration in a bad light?
No, he wants to make sure that the American people know that first and foremost, he's going to do everything he can within the law to make sure that they are protected from terrorists who want to harm us. And secondly, he wanted to make sure people knew that we do not torture. There is no torture. I think the President today wanted to make sure that given that there is so much interest going on 2 days, that he had an opportunity when he saw members of the press, that he take that opportunity to remind everybody of we are in a war. One of the things he's really concerned about is that every day that we get farther away from 9/11, that people will start forgetting the threats that we're under. Al-Qaeda is very serious. They're very patient. And the best source of information about how they're trying to harm us is from the terrorists themselves. Appropriate members of the Congress were briefed. Intelligence Committee members were briefed.
And so they're saying, you know, one of their complaints, obviously, is that these memos were done in secret, that they're secret memos.
I think the word secret is getting a little bit too much. It takes on the air of mystery, but one of the reasons they are secret is because they need to be. They need to be cloaked in the classified system so that we can keep that information private. We have talked about this a lot. There is a lot of information out there as to how the United States is going to deal with this. The policy of the United States that the President follows is not to torture people. And I believe that the members that have been briefed are satisfied that the policy of the United States and the practices do not constitute torture.
But Dana, what have they been briefed on? If they haven't actually seen like the 2005 legal opinions, they've just been briefed in general. You're selecting what they see.
What I can tell you, and I have been assured that they have been fully briefed.
Fully briefed on the actual memos?
Yes.
Okay, so then why are people like Senator Jay Rockefeller, he's the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, saying, I'm getting more information from the New York Times than from the White House?
I don't know, but I checked, and I am confident that the members were briefed.
When you say they're briefed, Dana, do you mean they are shown the techniques, they have the techniques explained to them, they understand what the techniques are?
I don't know. These are held in a classified setting. They're classified for a reason. And I don't know what they are shown.
And when you said they were briefed on the memos, did they see those memos or just were they just...
I don't know. I've been told they were fully briefed. And we feel confident that the information they were provided gives them the information that they need.
Why leave any ambiguity out there?
I think the key word is if, and I don't think there is ambiguity. We are not torturing. Well, what would make it better? What would make it better? That we should tell everybody exactly what we have? You want to know the techniques that we use so we can tell exactly Al-Qaeda what we're going to do? That's absurd.
No, but these members of Congress, not us, these members of Congress have security clearances. They see classified information all the time.
And the intelligence community was fully briefed.
You're saying that they did not. They were not fully briefed. You're saying fully briefed. That's your definition of fully briefed, just like it's your definition of torture. Jay Rockefeller, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, is saying they haven't seen the memos. So how can they be fully briefed if they haven't seen the memos? And why did you keep them secret if there's nothing in there that you're trying to hide?
The memos are applications that fall within the law, which is to not torture. It is absolutely important and critically important that we keep this information secret.
Goldsmith, you've got Jim Comey come forward and raise questions about whether or not it's been legal. It's not just Democrats on the Hill. People in your own Justice Department.
And I've said that reasonable people can disagree on complex questions. I don't think there is ambiguity. We are not torturing. I am not saying that reasonable people couldn't look at something and disagree when it comes to legal opinions. But the legal opinion of the United States is that we do not torture.
You know the way you look makes everyone hungry. You got the ways and means to make it alright. Dye your hair suicide blonde. Dye your hair suicide blonde. Lose your identity, wander in any direction. Yeah, that's the road to heaven's door. Dye your hair suicide blonde. Dye your hair suicide blonde. Been so long since you're gone. Yeah, you turn. Makes kid at the store. Dye your hair, suicide blonde. Dye your hair, suicide blonde. Dye your hair, suicide blonde. Dye your hair, suicide blonde.
Dana, this morning Secretary Rice testified in front of the House Foreign Relations Committee and said that errors were made in the case of Mayor Arar, the rendition of Arar to Syria where he was tortured, and that that the changes have to be made. Is the White House aware of this? And if so, what sort of changes is the administration thinking of in cases of rendition?
I'm not familiar. I didn't have a chance to see your testimony because I was in the cabinet room, so we'll have to get back to you. I would also notice that I saw a picture from that hearing where a lady in code pink with red painted on her hands disrupted the hearing, and I think it's despicable, and unfortunately it seems that increasingly Congress is being run by code pink.
Damn.
Recently, when President Ford died, there was a lot of revisionist discussion about his pardoning of Richard Nixon. And in most cases, both Democrats and Republicans got on the talk shows and said, well, as it turned out, it was a great unifier for the country at a time the country was very divided, chaos. And I think it's really quite the opposite, that when you have a precedent set like that, and you have somebody, George Tenet, acknowledging in his book that he knew that the administration was deceiving the American people into a situation that is murdering young men and women from this country and others, that George Tenet and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and George Bush et al. Should be in fucking jail. Some of your exes, you've been in fucking jail a few times.
I've never been in fucking jail, and I don't think we should. I don't know what you're talking
fucking
about.
No, jail. Huh? I was making.
Oh, in fucking jail.
I started representing Mr. Al-Jazawi at the end of 2005, and actually 2 years ago now, in October 2005. Lawyers were not even allowed onto the base until the Supreme Court in 2004 ruled that the men were entitled to attorneys. I think attorneys first started showing up later that fall after rules were set up to make it impossible for us to properly represent our clients.
And you do just have the one client there?
I have a second client who I've only seen a few times. He's not as interested in following any legal processes. He's not so interested in having an attorney because he has no confidence in the legal system in the United States, but I do file things on his behalf, and I visit him occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Well, who knows how many times military guys have gone in there and told him that they were his lawyer and then interrogated him. and tricked him. I've read quite a few reports of stories like that.
Yes, and I've heard those reports from both my clients that interrogators have come in and told them that they were attorneys. Both my clients wanted to have me prove to them that I was a real attorney when I went to see them the first time, which is kind of hard to do. I showed them my business card, and they both laughed. They're sophisticated enough to know that, you know, you can go to any public, you know, any printing company and print up cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I also carry with me my license from the state of Illinois, and the state of Illinois issues a license every year. And I've been an attorney now for 25 years. I have all 25 of them in my wallet. So when I started pulling them out for year after year, both of them had the same reaction. Okay, I believe you.
Well, that's good at least. At least they trust you.
Right.
Let's go ahead and stick with this theme of just, you know, basic Article 1, Section 9 and Bill of Rights type things here, you know, basic constitutional operations that we have in this country. You can't be tried for crimes that weren't crimes when you committed them. You can't be tried twice for the same crime. You're supposed to be allowed to talk with your lawyer in secret. Please, I'm sure there's more on the list.
Well, you're supposed to be told what you're charged with, and you're supposed to actually be charged with something. And neither of my clients have been charged with anything, and neither have been told what they're even being accused of. And since there is no evidence against them in any of the records, for my client, Mr. Al-Jazawi, I have seen what's called the classified file, which is the secret information about why he's being held. And it's garbage. There would be nothing to tell him, even if I was allowed to tell him, because there's nothing there. There's no accusation of any sort.
They don't even make a false accusation. They just say, well, this guy's, he is who he is, maybe a member of whatever he's a member of.
Yeah, he's an Arab. He was an Arab living in Afghanistan, married. And the main thing they seem to be questioning is why he got, how he got there. He must be a terrorist if he was living in Afghanistan.
So that really is the default. Any Arab, Afghan, so-called, is automatically an enemy combatant.
Right. Now, Afghanis are not Arab, so if you're an Arab in Afghanistan, that was considered suspicious. And American military actually sent out bounties. They airlifted them. They dropped them off planes, thousands and thousands of these bounty forms saying, turn over your terrorists, your murderers, your thieves, and we will give you enough money to care for your village for the rest of your life. Millions of dollars. It actually says millions of dollars in this bounty leaflet.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were turning over Arabs because they were strangers. Even though Mr. Al-Jazawi had lived there 6 or 7 years and was married and had a young daughter, he was picked up in a part of Afghanistan where he didn't live because he went with his wife and daughter when the bombing started to her family's village.
Mm.
They did not know him. They thought they could get enough money to care for their village for the rest of their lives. Out he goes.
What about that? What about torture? Has your client been tortured down there in Guantanamo Bay?
He has in the early days. And I have to tell you, we finally talked about all of that in my last visit. And my notes were just cleared yesterday. And I haven't had, and they weren't all cleared. The government has held a couple of pages of my notes as classified.
Which means that you can't repeat whatever you know it said to me?
Right. And I haven't had a chance to review it to know what has been cleared and what hasn't. But I can tell you in the early days, the early years of his stay at Guantanamo, he was tortured. And I can tell you that there's a different form of torture going on now because now most of the men are in two camps at Guantanamo. They're called Camps 5 and 6. They're kept in solitary confinement 22 to 24 hours a day, depending on the day. They have no natural light. The only fresh air they have is if they get that 1 or 2 hours outside. But sometimes that's offered to them at 3 o'clock in the morning, at which time most of the detainees, including Mr. Al-Jazawi, don't want to get up from sleep to go stand out in the dark.
Mm.
They have no one to talk to, even if there are prison cells around them, which there's only 4 or 5 in this area, but there's no way of talking to the detainees unless you get on the floor and yell through the hole where the food is shoved in.
Mm.
So this is another form of torture. They get one book a week, but it's the same books that have been there for years. So they have nothing to do. I asked Mr. Al-Jazawi what he does, how he spends his time now. I mean, I can tell he's losing his mind. This has been 7 months. No, I'm sorry, it's longer than that. It was December when he was moved there, 06. He washes his clothes over and over again and paces. And he can only pace one or two steps because he's so weak, and then he sits down and washes his clothes some more.
And I think you wrote either at In These Times or the Huffington Post that last time you saw him, he told you that he's catching himself talking out loud to no one.
Yes.
A sure sign of mental breakdown there.
Yeah, I mean, there is no one to talk to, so he's found himself talking and answering to himself. You know, we talked about this. He's very scared. He doesn't want to lose his mind. He has hope still that he will get out of there and see his young daughter, who's now just over 6 years old, who he hasn't seen since she was a couple months old. And he doesn't want to lose his mind. He doesn't want to have his body completely wrecked, which he's in such bad shape. But, you know, we talked about what he can do. We talked about trying to read, but now his eyes are going. He's having trouble reading. He gets headaches, and his eyes are all dry, and he said it's just impossible to read anymore. So he's got to think and try to remember things, try to exercise a little, even though it's so hard for him. But, you know, we've talked about little things that he could try to do to try to keep his mental health as positive as possible and try to not let his body succumb to the hepatitis.
It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton talking with Candace Gorman. You're a lawyer. Tell me, shouldn't these guys be hung from ropes until they're dead, the people that run our government who've done this?
I think they should be tried. I think they'll be found guilty, and I think they should be imprisoned for the rest of their lives.
I mean, there's precedents for this, right? War crimes trials and so forth in the past?
Yes, Nuremberg is a good example.
Well, what are the parallels between our current situation in Nuremberg? Surely you're not comparing the Department of Justice to the Gestapo.
Not exactly, but I was actually just saying that there is a background for doing war crimes trials, and Nuremberg is one. I don't think I would compare our Justice Department to the Gestapo, but I would compare it to the very worst of the worst of judicial systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, you wrote an article, I guess, where you compared the military to the Gestapo.
Yes, I have.
And what was the comparison there?
I can't remember the exact article that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it was the torture techniques. It was the, yeah, we're torturing them, but look, there's not a bruise on them. We didn't do nothing.
Yeah, and, you know, I read something interesting from the Justice Department. I forgot the man's name. I might have written about it on my blog, who has said why what they're doing is not torture. And he said that the Supreme Court has said that torture is conduct that shakes the conscience. And his conscience hasn't been shaken by anything they're doing. So he doesn't think it's unconstitutional. For one thing, that's a dishonest review of what the Supreme Court has said, because it's not anyone in particular's conscience. It's humanity's conscience. And certainly humanity's conscience has been shaken by what we've been doing at Guantanamo, at Abu Ghraib, at the many black hole sites around the world.
Well, and for those whose consciences aren't shaken, why don't you do us a favor and tell us about what happens to Guantanamo detainees who decide to go on a hunger strike and how the doctors go about keeping them alive.
Yeah, and we have our poor reporter from Al Jazeera who is part of that hunger strike and is losing his mind and body as we speak. What they do is they take a tube. I actually had this, I actually witnessed this procedure at a conference of Guantanamo attorneys back in the spring. They have this tube. Now, there is a very small tube that can be used and is actually used in hospitals, but we don't use that small tube. We use this tube that's an eighth of an inch thick. It gets put down. I think it's 7 or 8 feet long. It gets put down their nose, down their throat, and into their stomach. Although sometimes they miss and it goes through their windpipes, and then they choke and they gag and they throw up. They're strapped in these chairs. Every part of their body is strapped. Their head is strapped. Their neck is strapped. Their arms are strapped to the arms of the chair in a couple of different places. Their waist is strapped. Their legs are strapped. And the tube is taken out every time. They're fed, and for some of these men, they're being fed 2 and 3 times a day now because they are dying, because they want to die, because they don't want to stay in indefinite detention without charges. and this is their only way of protesting. So this is being done to them two or three times a day, where the tube is taken in and taken out and taken in. It's a very cruel, cruel mechanism.
And not even shoved down their throat, but shoved up their nostril, is that it?
Yep. It starts going from going into the nostril, then down the throat.
You know, it's funny because I guess my first reaction is to compare the American regime to the Nazi regime. This is how they treated their prisoners, at least some of them. But I guess the other comparison could be made that this is not how Americans treated literal Nazis when they were our prisoners of war.
Yes, and I think I'm trying to remember who the was one of the military officials was, and I'm not sure if it was Mo Davis. There's a couple of people I write about who have been my nemesis over these years who have talked about the fact that the Koreans did this, the North Koreans did conduct like this. And I'm thinking, so what is this? What, is this our goal, to sink to a level of an enemy that we said was engaged in war crimes when they had this conduct, when they engaged in this conduct? I don't understand. And, you know, this isn't just a detention to keep them off a battlefield. First, you have to understand most of these men were never found on a battlefield. Based on the government's own records, something like 92% of these people were not on a battlefield. They were not picked up by American forces. They were turned over to American forces.
90 what percent? 92% according to the government's own documents were simply just sold by the Northern Alliance or a local group of villagers somewhere.
And the Pakistanis, you know, yeah. Musharraf in his Kiss and Tell book last year talked about the millions of dollars the Pakistani government made turning over Arabs that were visiting. Some were tourists visiting Pakistan because there was so much money that was being offered by our government for anybody. And no questions were being asked.
Let's just talk about who is at Guantanamo. You know, I think a lot of Americans, when after 9/11 and after the attacks in Afghanistan, when you know, had the belief that hundreds of these combatants were taken to Guantanamo, and while there certainly may have been some people who were innocently caught up in them, that there was it was an extraordinary situation, and they were prepared to tolerate some, you know, some different procedures. As you can best tell, how many of those who were taken to Guantanamo were actually captured on the battlefield?
Well, it's a very, very small number. And I should say this, that when I first went down there, I shared what you said. I thought the vast majority of them were going to have been involved in fighting in Afghanistan. And, you know, my thing was the principle that we should give everyone a fair hearing. But I thought, honestly, that I was going to have a lot of explaining to do for some of these prisoners. But it turns out that there's a very, very small number. And when you learn the facts, it's actually quite logical. What was going on was this. The U.S. was dropping these leaflets all over Pakistan and Afghanistan offering $5,000 bounties. And $5,000 in that neck of the woods is a lot of money. It would translate in American terms to about $250,000 to what we're used to getting paid. So, you know, think for a minute what you would do if there was someone you didn't like, who was some foreigner, who you were just being asked to say, oh, I saw him in Tora Bora, and you get $250,000. The problem was a vast number of people got turned in with one of those stories that were just false. Well, then we followed up with these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which, you know, is really a euphemism for torture, and we start abusing people. And, of course, they'll confess pretty quickly that it was true. Yeah, I was in Tora Bora. But then that gets you a one-way ticket to Guantanamo. Unfortunately, there are no lawyers, there's no courts, there's no way of checking out whether it's true. And we've ended up having just a huge number of people there who had nothing to do with any fighting. And, you know, you see that now. Even amongst the allegations made by the U.S. military, there's a very small proportion who are alleged to have actually been fighting anybody.
You said that a lot of people who really were innocent of any connections to terrorism have been caught up, were caught by forces given to the United States and ended up in Guantanamo Bay. What is the review process for seeing whether the accusations against them are credible? Aren't there regular review tribunals which at least review some of that material and are designed to weed out those who have been mistakenly captured?
Well, unfortunately, those tribunals are not up to much. The prisoners are not allowed lawyers. They're not allowed to know the evidence against them. They're not allowed to know many of the allegations against them. And, you know, we have continually asked just to be given a list of what the allegations are to be able to rebut them. And those allegations change over time so much. Each time, for example, with Sami Alhaj, who's an Al Jazeera journalist I represent down there, they've come up with new allegations. I've proved those allegations are false, and then they come up with something else. The most recent things that they gave to him on September the 11th of this year alleges that his terrorist training, if you'll believe it, involves the following, and I quote, "The detainee was trained in the use of cameras by Al Jazeera," end quote. Now, you know, I stipulate that's true. Of course that's true. He worked for them, but it's not a crime. And yet, this is the allegation of training that's meant to prove he's a terrorist.
For a different perspective on the conditions at Guantanamo Bay and the legal status of its detainees, we turn to the U.S. government's chief counsel there. Captain Pat McCarthy is staff judge advocate for the U.S. Task Force Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He's been at Guantanamo since May of 2006. He spoke to us from his office on the base. Well, Captain McCarthy, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's discuss some of the allegations that Clive Stafford Smith makes in his book based on his experiences representing detainees at Guantanamo. One of the things he says in this book is that 5 years after they were brought to Guantanamo, fewer than one half of detainees have actually met a lawyer. Does that sound right to you?
I don't think so. I think that right now we have about 300 or so detainees that are represented by counsel. All of the detainees have been advised of their right to meet with counsel. All of the detainees have been advised of their right under the Detainee Treatment Act to challenge their combatant status review tribunal. This year alone, my office has facilitated nearly 1,100. That's 1,100 lawyer visits. That's lawyers here on the ground. So I understand what Mr. Smith is saying, but I just have to say that it certainly doesn't bear out here with my office and the things that we undertake every single day.
Okay, so everyone has been advised of their right to see a lawyer. I mean, I don't want to split hairs here, but have they been able to get one? I mean, do they have access to them? Have they actually met one?
Absolutely right. Yes, we had put into place an arrangement with the American Bar Association to represent those detainees who had requested to have attorneys assigned to challenge their combatant status review tribunals. We have the detainees talk among themselves. They are aware of their own lawyers. There are multiple mechanisms by which detainees who would like to have a lawyer can get a lawyer.
Okay. One of the things that Clive Stafford Smith says that there are obstacles to lawyers establishing trust with detainees, and one of them is that it appears that all of the detainees have been told all their lawyers are Jewish, and one of his clients said that he'd been told that his lawyer likes to have sex with men. Have you come across anything like that?
I haven't. In fact, okay. I don't know how to respond to that. That's a kind of a naked allegation with no basis in terms of any kind of documentary evidence or anything. I mean, it's difficult for me to prove a negative.
Sure.
But I can say that we have never seen any evidence of that. We have looked into it because those allegations have been made, and we do look into these sorts of allegations. So it's not as if we haven't spoken to intelligence gathering personnel, the interrogators and so forth. It's not as if we haven't looked at the records. But we have found nothing which would indicate to us that that is the case.
Okay.
So...
You know, one of the questions that's raised, I think, in Clive Stafford's book overall is whether a large number of detainees at Guantanamo perhaps shouldn't have been there. I mean, I think it's understood a lot of people would expect that in a chaotic environment such as the U.S. action in Afghanistan, a lot of people were captured. And I think most people would expect that the great majority of those captured were clearly enemy combatants or involved in terrorist activity or something like that. But he seems to suggest that a great many, probably a majority, might even have been mistakenly captured. And one of the ways, of course, that is reviewed by the U.S. military are these combatant status review tribunals, which are, if I understand this correctly, held to determine whether an individual detainee should be kept. Is that right?
Not precisely. We've heard this claim before that, obviously, that we have swept up people in on the battlefield and they made their way to Guantanamo. Just to sort of go through the process, the first thing that happens on the battlefield is there's an assessment made as to who the individual is at the time that they're brought into U.S. custody. Thousands of individuals are temporarily detained by the U.S. military in connection with military operations. A fraction of those that are initially detained are actually held for any longer term period. A fraction of those that are held for a longer term period come into sort of a moderate term period of detention, and a fraction of those made their way to Guantanamo. So the fact of the matter is that the Department of Defense has had an ongoing process to validate the identity and the affiliations of individuals who come into our detention. Now, with respect to the Combatant Status Review Tribunals...
Well, can I just interrupt you on that particular point, Captain? I mean, Clive Stafford Smith's book cites an analysis done by Mark Denbaugh of the Seton Hall Law School, which concluded that 95% of those at Guantanamo were not actually captured by U.S. forces, but were turned over by Pakistanis and Northern Alliance forces in Afghanistan, many of whom were responding to cash bounties that were available to turn over suspicious people. And I guess that surprised me, if it's true. It seemed as if a great... I sort of suspected that most of the folks at Guantanamo had been captured by U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Is it not the case that the great majority were actually turned over to U.S. forces, often by people collecting a bounty?
The Denbaugh study is based upon unclassified information that was released in connection with the CSIRTs, or the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, back in 2005. It is flawed. It is based on less than half of the available information. West Point has done a counter study, and the West Point study contradicted a vast majority of the findings of the Denbaugh study. And the West Point study had access to, because it was a government-run study, had access to greater information than the Denbaugh study had. The fact is, yes, there were a proportion of individuals that were captured by Pakistanis. These were individuals who had come out of Tora Bora and had slipped across the Pakistani border and were trying to get out of Pakistan and back to their home countries. There were also a certain number of individuals where there were rewards paid with respect to those that were brought forward by villagers and so forth and so on. It is a relatively small number of people that in cases where rewards were paid. And the fact of the matter is that the majority of individuals who are in Guantanamo were captured in Afghanistan by U.S. or coalition forces. Now, because I do have this opportunity, I would say that the American people, I believe, would expect that the U.S. would not stop at the Afghan-Pakistan border and simply throw up their hands and say, well, they got away. In addition to the individuals who were not captured in Afghanistan, is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He wasn't captured in Afghanistan, and numerous others. And the fact is that we did take individuals from various areas in and around Afghanistan. We brought them in, and then we did the same thing as I described previously, where we went through, we validated the identity of the individual, the affiliation of the individual, and that individual's activities. And it's through that validation process that we are comfortable that we, in fact, do have individuals that warrant detention in Guantanamo Bay.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the process by which their status is reviewed. That's the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. And again, this is not a trial for a crime. This is a review in part to determine whether they are, you know, indeed have a status that would require their retention at Guantanamo. Tell us a little bit about what happens there. Do the detainees in these proceedings get to look at? Are they informed of evidence against them? Are they represented by anyone?
They're not represented. And to back up, what the Combatant Status Review Tribunals are essentially a process by which the initial battlefield determination of enemy combatancy is confirmed. So it doesn't actually determine that an individual is an enemy combatant. It confirms that the individual is an enemy combatant. So what happens there is the tribunal sits, the tribunal considers information which the U.S. government holds on a particular individual. The detainee is granted access to unclassified information that may pertain to him. He's also given an unclassified summary of information that that is developed off of classified information. There is an individual called a personal representative that assists the detainee in preparation of his general response to the factual predicate that the U.S. government is using to determine the to confirm that the individual is an enemy combatant. What happens is that the CSRT, the tribunal itself, is required to look at all information, both information that would indicate the individual is an enemy combatant, as well as information that would indicate he is not, or would indicate somehow or undermine the case against the detainee. The tribunal takes all of that into account as it makes its determination as to whether the initial finding is correct. So in terms of its confirmation of that earlier battlefield battlefield assessment that an individual is an enemy combatant.
And is the detainee allowed to address the tribunal in these proceedings?
The detainee is allowed to address the tribunal, and the detainee is allowed to call witnesses that are reasonably available.
Car's on fire, and there's no driver at the wheel. And the sewers are all muddied with 1,000 lonely suicides. And a dark wind blows. The government is corrupt, and we're on so many drugs with the radio on and the curtains drawn. We're trapped in the belly of this horrible machine, and the machine is bleeding to death. The sun has fallen down, and the billboards are all leering, and the flags are all dead at the top of their poles. It went like this. The buildings toppled in on themselves. Mothers clutching babies picked through the rubble and pulled out their hair. The skyline was beautiful on fire. Twisted metal stretching upwards. Everything washed in a thin orange haze. I said, kiss me, you're beautiful. These are truly the last days. You grabbed my hand, and we fell into it like a daydream or a fever.
My name is Danny Waller. I'm 44 years old. The character that I've played was the ghost of Hamlet's father. The reason I chose that, when I first read the script, the words jumped out at me. And they made me feel things that I haven't felt before.
What in your experience drew you to those particular words?
I took a man's life, and I felt he was talking to me through that. That he wanted me to know what I put him through. I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day confined to fasting fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt, purged away. But that I am forbid to tell the secrets of my prison house, I could a tale unfold, whose lightest words would harrow up thy soul, freeze thy young blood, and make thy two eyes like stars start from their spheres. There's one other spot that goes like this. Thus was I, sleeping, by a brother's hand of life, of crown, of queen at once dispatched, cut off even in the blossoms of my sin, no reckoning made, but sent to my account with all my imperfections on my head. And it was pretty much the same way with him. He was taken before his time.
So when you read the character, do you feel like who's talking when you say those lines?
I'm the body up there, but the words are coming from mostly William Pride, the man that I killed. He's mostly the one talking.
There's not much defense between the actor and the word as you get with an actor who puts his or her training between the two. These guys call it like they see it, and it's true. It's just dead true.
That's Agnes, the director. Besides putting on plays at the Missouri Eastern Correctional Center visiting room, she's mounted shows on more familiar stages, the acclaimed Actor Studio in New York, the Berkshire Festival in Stockbridge, and the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut. After becoming the artistic director of the New Theater in St. Louis, she started an outreach program to take professional actors doing dramatic works by writers like Don DeLillo and perform them before prison audiences. In time, the prisoners became the actors, and in more time, this side project took over her entire theater company. Now, this is what she does, directing prisoners who may not have the chops of professional actors, but have an intimacy with the material that doesn't exist anywhere else.
When Claudius is in the chapel and speaks about his sin and his regret and his ability to undo it, it broke my heart because the man playing it felt all of those things fully. And you know, I know these guys have deep regrets, but it was palpable. The audience was stunned. You could hear a pin drop. And that was especially true with the inmate audience. He says, "Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it, a brother's murder.
A brother's murder.
Pray can I not.
Pray can I not. Though inclination be sharp as will. My stronger guilt defeats my strong intent. What if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood? Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow?"
My name is Edgar Evans, and I'm 39 years old, and I play the King Claudius in Hamlet.
"And like a man to double business bound, I stand in pause where I should first begin, and both neglect."
I don't consider myself no great actor or nothing, but I try to do the best I can. And when I did the speech, I was looking upward. The chapel was at the incline there. And I was just looking up toward the top, and it's like no one was there but me. I honestly didn't see a soul in the chapel when I was saying this. Maybe even, and I'm just, you know, I'm not saying this, but it seemed almost like I was praying this actual speech to God.
But oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder. That cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder. My crown, my own ambition, and my queen.
I have a wife and four kids, and by being incarcerated, I felt that I've really let them down.
What rest?
When I said that speech and my wife was here in the visiting room, I don't know if it had an impact on her. I don't even know if she truly understood all of the content, I wanted her to hear that speech more than anybody.
Oh, wretched state, oh, bosom black as death, oh, limed soul struggling to be free or more engaged. Help angels, make assay, bow stubborn knee, and hearts with string of steel, be soft as sinews of the newborn babe, all may be well.
We are in the prison chapel where the first performance will be held before an audience of inmates. 6 months after my first visit, it is, at last, showtime.
Alan, how you doing today?
Armed guards let the audience in the door one by one. Agnes calls her actors together in a corner and gives them the final pep talk.
Paul? Edgar, could I have you? Okay.
Okay, team.
Things to think about. Make sure to stand still on yours and other people's punchlines. If something falls apart, pick it up. Go somewhere with it. Make up words. I don't think anybody here has memorized it, so we're safe. And mostly, this afternoon, people were working so hard, I don't think you had much fun. Hard work's behind us. This is the night to just have a blast.
Okay, one for the team.
One for the team.
Ready?
One for the team.
Set.
Once the play starts, Danny and Stan deliver their lines okay. But all that antique Elizabethan wordplay isn't connecting with the audience. But then midway through the scene, the crowd starts to really respond to the emotion in Ophelia's funeral march. Laertes is the last mourner, humming at the side of the grave, tossing rose petals on her corpse. Right away, the action picks up. The Hamlets appear, taunting Laertes about the sincerity of his grief. They quarrel and exchange insults. A duel is proposed, which culminates in the last sword fight scene. Most directors block this scene as a professional fencing match. Agnes has it looking like a knife fight in an alley. The audience totally gets it. Word holds his arms slightly out from his sides, his hand gripping his sword like he would a shiv. He and one of the Hamlets are circling each other like thugs. Word jerks his shoulders forward, a pure back-alley feint, a fake movement to intimidate his opponent, something all of them have probably seen right in the yard. Then the room goes quiet as the actors start slicing one another, leading to Laertes' death scene.
Hamlet, thou art slain. No medicine in the world can do thee good. In thee, it's not in half an hour's life. The treacherous instrument is in your hand. Yeah. Unbated and envenomed. the foul practice has turned itself on me. No. Here I lie, never to rise again. Exchange forgiveness with me, noble Hamlet, that mine and my father's debt be not upon thee.
The audience, like a living thing, leans forward in unison to watch words slide down the chapel wall and die. There are no cackles of discomfort, no shouts from the gallery, just breathless silence, the silence of recognition. In all, there were three performances, and on the final night, before family and dignitaries, the entire cast found the magic that Paul said would happen during that first read-through. The actors knew that this would be the last time they'd get to perform as a group. So when Danny and Stan came out for their final Gravedigger appearance, somehow those Elizabethan jokes worked.
Aren't they heathen? How does thou understand the scripture? The scripture says Adam digged. Could he dig without arms?
Having seen every performance, I can testify, the actors rose above their talents in that last show. Mike and Hudson as the belligerent priests, Buck and Tommy as the ambassadors, Sylvester's Fortinbras. You could feel the mutual support. Just as mislines and other mistakes play off one another and can spiral downward into fiasco, the rhythm of the room can go the other way, too. Strong lines beget better performances. The gang of Hamlets came together in a way they hadn't before. That little mob seemed like one voice. But the real surprise for me that last night was Hutch.
I'm more an antique Roman than a Dane. There's still yet some liquor left.
It's here that Hutch's Horatio delivers his most famous line. The play is almost over. He's surrounded by corpses and speaks to his dying friend Hamlet. In the other performances, I always thought Hutch had been plagued by what you might call the Jack Nicholson syndrome. The actor's persona is bigger than any role he might play. But tonight, Horatio has Hutch under control and the audience in his hand. He has the one great line to deliver, and as Hutch might say, he nails it.
Now I'm cracked, see, noble heart. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
So Hamlet dies, and Fortinbras takes over, and then the drums of Hamlet's funeral begin. On other stages, a curtain would fall, but here, beneath the cafeteria's unforgiving fluorescence, the actors just stop. From the back of the room, Agnes says simply,
"End of play."
Show notes at lies.com. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.